I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. There was a raucous scene outside the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday as the eight justices heard arguments in a case involving restrictions at abortion clinics in Texas. Whole Woman's Health v. Helderstedt was brought by several Texas abortion clinics and three doctors asking the court to remove restrictions passed by the Texas legislature in 2013. That law required abortion clinics to meet ambulatory surgical center standards, and the doctors have admitting privileges at a hospital nearby to protect the health of the female patients. The plaintiffs argued that the restrictions are costly and unnecessary, that have resulted in clinic closures, and denying women the right to an abortion, a constitutionally protected procedure. We've asked Amy Howe to get things started in this hour of Radio Times, editor and reporter at SCOTUS Blog, something she's been doing since 2003. And Amy Howe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So what was it like inside the courtroom yesterday, missing Justice Scalia?
Inside the courtroom, it was a very interesting dynamic. It was the first major oral argument since the death of Justice Scalia on February 13th. And the more conservative justices really were a little bit subdued. This was definitely a case in which I think it would have been a very different argument if he'd been there. He was well known as a foe of abortion rights. And the court's four more liberal justices were very active, both challenging the lawyer representing Texas, and occasionally Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg would sort of step in to help out the lawyer representing the challengers. And Justice Scalia often would play a similar role, you know, throwing a softball or asking tough questions in these high-profile cases. And no one on the court's among the court's more conservative justices really stepped up to fill that role.
And what did Justice Kennedy do? In many cases, all eyes are on Kennedy. What did he do or say or ask yesterday?
Well, this was definitely a case. I mean, actually, before the oral argument started, the joke in the press room was that you could basically write the plot line of your story in advance. And the court's four more liberal justices were strongly opposed to the regulations. The court's three remaining more conservative justices were likely to uphold them. And what did Justice Kennedy think? And he didn't ask a lot of questions. The questions that he asked suggested to me that, you know, we're not likely to see, you know, he could vote with the court's three more conservative justices to uphold the regulations. And that would leave us with a 4-4 tie. Mm-hmm. Which would mean either they'd have to order re-argument at some point when there's a new justice on the court, or the decision of the Fifth Circuit upholding the regulations would stand. But it wouldn't set a nationwide precedent. It didn't seem, I mean, that would be sort of the best result, I think, that Texas could hope for. But he didn't ask a lot of questions, so he was hard to read. But the few questions that he did ask seemed to suggest either that he might be leaning toward striking down the regulations, joining the court's former liberal justices so the vote could be 5-3, or that he might be interested in sending the case back to the lower courts for more gathering of facts about what the effect of this law has actually been. And that would, you know, I think from his perspective, maybe allow him to make a more informed decision about what to do, about whether or not this is really hurting women in Texas by making it much more difficult for them to get abortions. But it would also conveniently sort of kick the can down the road, but the case could come back to the Supreme Court at a time when there might be 9 justices on the court again.
And what were the arguments coming from the plaintiffs?
So the arguments coming from the plaintiffs, I mean, the basic argument is that, you know, the Supreme Court has said that states, that there is a basic right to have an abortion, but that states can impose some restrictions on that right, as long as it doesn't constitute an undue burden on women who are seeking access to abortions. And their argument is really that these restrictions are going to close so many clinics and make it so much harder for women in Texas to get abortions that you're basically taking away that right to the abortion. They pointed to the number of clinics that had shut down when the law had gone into effect. And argued basically that these restrictions are going to make it so hard for the existing clinics to stay in business or for new clinics to open in the future.
And what is the argument, I guess, coming from Texas or coming from the state about the need to have abortion clinics that meet these ambulatory surgical center standards? What is their argument?
Their argument is that these restrictions, the legislature put them into effect to protect the health of women in Texas, that, you know, that there have been complications with abortions. I think that the figure is something around 200 complications in Texas per year, and that the Texas, that there still is a right to abortions, but we just want them to be safe abortions, is the gist of Texas's argument.
Also, part of it's called HB2, right? This particular law we're talking about, it does include something that didn't seem as if it was argued before the Supreme Court yesterday, which was to say there would be no abortions in Texas after 20 weeks. Can you expand on that?
That wasn't really one of the provisions that was before the court, and so this is actually, you know, that's certainly something, you know, one target of groups that oppose abortion and legislatures who appoint abortions. It did come up sort of tangentially in the sense that Justice Kennedy was concerned that some of the requirements, for example, there's a requirement that if you're going to have a medical abortion, you're going to take a pill or two pills to cause the abortion, and if it were to become more difficult for women in Texas to obtain those, then you might wind up having to have a surgical abortion, which could push it later into the pregnancy. But it didn't really come up at the oral arguments yesterday.
Now, the plaintiffs have argued that something like half of the abortion clinics in Texas have closed. Was their argument that this law that was passed in 2013, that this law has resulted in the closure of about half of the abortion clinics in Texas?
That is their argument, and that was something that the court's more conservative justices brought up, and which eventually, you know, was part of what led to Justice Kennedy's suggestion that perhaps this case should go back to the lower courts for more fact gathering. I think, you know, everyone has assumed all along that, you know, the laws went into effect and the abortion clinics closed, and that therefore the two were related. But Justice Samuel Alito, who's one of the court's more conservative justices, and the Chief Justice were really pressing Stephanie Todi, who represented the challengers, on whether this was a question of causation or correlation, and why wasn't there more evidence in the record to show that these clinics closed because of the law. But Justice Elena Kagan, one of the court's more liberal justices, said, you know, basically this is the perfect controlled experiment. You know, there were these abortion clinics in Texas. The law went into effect. Some of the clinics closed, and then the law was blocked, and they reopened. Clearly, the two are related. But this was one of the sort of one of these things that perhaps some of the justices may be looking to avoid ruling on the merits of the case by sending the case back to a lower court.
And I mean, when's the last time the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on an abortion case?
It's been several years, and Justice Anthony Kennedy actually wrote the decision. It was involved partial birth abortions. It was called Gonzalez versus Carhart. It was either 2006 or 2007. So, you know, not only was it the first major case since the death of Justice Scalia, but it was the first time in several years that the court had weighed in on abortion. And, you know, obviously we've had some changes on the court since then, with Justice John Paul Stevens and Justice David Souter being replaced by Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan.
You had mentioned this undue burden provision. This was part of a case which we'll be talking about in more detail after the break, because it involves Pennsylvania. But I guess, yes, did the court in any way come to some kind of consensus about what an undue burden would constitute for a woman seeking an abortion?
That is actually sort of the $64,000 question. Is, you know, the Supreme Court in 1992, in this case Planned Parenthood versus Casey, said that states cannot impose an undue burden on women seeking an abortion. But the question is, what exactly does that mean? And the Chief Justice John Roberts seemed to think at yesterday's oral argument, you know, he said an undue burden are states putting a substantial obstacle in the way of women seeking an abortion. And his sort of line of thinking, I think, wouldn't have any room for an inquiry into whether, you know, in this case, something like the state's rationale that this law is intended to protect women's health come in, you know, and the court's former liberal justices spent a lot of time yesterday trying to debunk that rationale. And the Chief Justice's line of thinking, I think, whether or not the states rationale that the states offered actually did advance women's health wouldn't come into question at all. But for the court's former liberal justices, they seem to think, well, if the state says it's to protect women's health and it really doesn't, does that change the inquiry into the undue burden test? So that is a question that the court may or may not answer in this case, but it's certainly an open question and one that a lot of people are very interested in.
And did the court talk about Dr. Kermit Gosnell? We'll be talking about this later in the hour as well. And this is the abortion doctor. He's now in prison, convicted of murder. He did abortions and did late-term abortions. Did his name come up yesterday?
It did indeed. Relatively close to the end of the oral argument, when the court's former liberal justices were really pressing Scott Keller, the Solicitor General of Texas, on the idea that it was intended to protect women's health. And they said, you know, there haven't been that many complications. And perhaps most significantly from their perspective, they said, you know, abortions are supposed to be in these ambulatory surgical centers. But there are lots of other procedures. They mentioned colonoscopies and liposuction that are far riskier than abortions, but aren't required to be in these surgical centers, that can be done in a doctor's office. And they said, essentially, why is Texas singling out abortion for this special treatment? And the Kermit Gosnell case was one of the justifications, one of the things that Scott Keller, the Solicitor General of Texas, pointed to. He said, you know, part of it was a reaction to the Gosnell case in Philadelphia, wanting to make sure that something like that didn't happen in Texas. Justice Samuel Alito then chimed in, and he said, well, wasn't. One of the clinics at issue in this case, in fact, cited for serious violations, for example, holes in the floor that would have allowed rats to come through. And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's about to turn 83 this month, but was very vibrant at the oral argument yesterday, said, you know, that was totally different. In Philadelphia, they hadn't had inspections in 15 years. In Texas, they have regular inspections, and there's not as much of a concern that something like the Kermit Gosnell case could repeat itself in Texas.
And, Amy, we're almost out of time. So when do you expect the court to make its decision?
You know, it's an interesting question. If the court were to deadlock 4-4, we could know that quite soon. But I think if I were a betting person, I would say that we will be waiting for this one, you know, at the end of June as the court wraps up its term.
Well, thank you so much for getting our conversation started, joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. And again, Amy Howe, editor and reporter at SCOTUS Blog. We will continue our conversation. We've got two more guests who will be joining us talking about yesterday's case before the U.S. Supreme Court and also its connection to Planned Parenthood v. Casey here in Philadelphia. And as I mentioned, the case of Dr. Kermit Gosnell. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Ballot Talks here on Radio Times. The Hellerstedt case heard yesterday before the U.S. Supreme Court has its roots in a 1992 Pennsylvania case, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, that upheld Roe and gave states the right to enact abortion restrictions. Another Pennsylvania case, the horrifying conditions at a Philadelphia clinic where Dr. Kermit Gosnell did abortions, has been used by abortion critics to argue about the dangers of abortions that put women's health at risk. Gosnell was convicted of murder and is in prison. Well, joining us now is Nina Martin, reporter at ProPublica, covering sex and gender. And Nina Martin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, in fact, here with us in our Philadelphia studio is David S. Cohen. He's a professor of law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Wrote a book, co-authored a book, I should say, called Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. And David, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, David. And just, you were there at the court. You happened to be able to get inside to observe the hearing. What was your takeaway?
It was really a split argument, as Amy was telling us before. The first 15 minutes were almost all procedural, talking about do we have enough facts? Is the prior case that was brought a couple years ago, does that preclude this case? But then it took an abrupt turn and really went into the merits. And the liberals on the court really dominated. They took over the argument. They pressed Texas to really explain their reasons. They weren't buying it at all. And in particular, Justices Kagan and Sotomayor lit up the argument with really pointed, smart questions, focusing on the absurdity of the Texas law in trying to protect women's health by shutting down medical clinics. To them, it didn't make sense.
And was that the argument, the sort of nub of their argument?
Yeah, Texas's argument was that this is for women's health, and the liberal justices weren't buying it, and they may have gotten Justice Kennedy to see the absurdity as well.
Interesting. Nina, why is this case important?
Well, this case is important first of all, Texas is the largest state in the country with these kinds of abortion restrictions. So the case is, the restrictions are particularly harsh, impact, depending on how you count it, hundreds of thousands of women. You've already talked about how many clinics may have been closed as a result of the restrictions. One of the things that really strikes me is that if the restrictions go into effect fully, there will be no abortion clinics in West Texas, so anywhere west of San Antonio, which is an enormous part of the huge area. The case is obviously also really important because it's a test of it's sort of a showdown over not just the kinds of restrictions that have been passed in states over the last few years, in particular, really since about 2011, when the Tea Party wave hit and took over legislatures around the country, but also of this standard that was articulated or that was adopted by the Supreme Court in 1992 in this case called Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which is this undue burden standard, which was, very much a compromise. It was a huge change from Roe. It really allowed states to enact the kinds of restrictions that Roe had, many of the kinds of restrictions that Roe had pretty much banned, but it also did not go as far as anti-abortion opponents wanted. It didn't allow them to states to pass anything as long as they had a rational basis. It was a sort of this intermediate kind of standard, the undue burden standard, that's now, as Amy said, is really at the,
sure,
the crux
at
of the
heart of this.
The arguments. Yeah.
Well, let me just read, and there's so many ways I could quote this, but here's one having to do with the undue burden standard. And David, I'll toss this to you. A law is invalid, quote, if its purpose or effect is to place substantial obstacles in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability. I mean, if we want to try to understand what undue burden is about, does that language help us?
Yeah, I mean, that's the court's definition of what an undue burden is. But even that isn't very clear. If the test is that you can't have an undue burden, that means some burdens are perfectly fine. If the test is that you can't have a substantial obstacle, that means you can have obstacles. You just can't have substantial obstacles. So what is a substantial obstacle? It's hard to know without looking at what the court has done. And the problem, the difficulty for pro-choice advocates is that in the same case, the Casey case, where the court announced this test, it approved almost every one of Pennsylvania's regulations, except for the requirement that a married woman notify her husband.
But things like waiting periods?
24-hour waiting period, an informed consent process that goes above and beyond what any medical procedure has, including with misleading brochures given from the state, a requirement that minors get a parent's consent. Everything was approved by the court, except for the requirement that a woman notify her husband, which was an indication that this substantial obstacle test, even though there was plenty of evidence in that case that the other requirements placed a serious obstacle on women's right to choose, they approved everything except for the spousal notification, which gives an indication that this test is pretty forgiving on the states, unfortunately, in my mind.
Well, let me go back to you, Nina. And David, I'd love to have you weigh in on this as well, because what seems to have happened since Planned Parenthood v. Casey is that and it looks as if the National Right to Life Committee campaign has been very effective, which is looking at states, figuring out what kinds of regulations, forcing abortion clinics to abide by these surgical standards. And when you look across the states, it looks like a number of them, maybe about half of them, have appropriated or used some of these restrictions. Let me go back to you, Nina. What was the thinking, I guess, behind, and they're called TARP laws, Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers?
Well, the thinking about TARP laws, TRAP laws, I think.
It is TRAP laws. You're right.
Yeah. First of all, there was a feeling among anti-abortion in the anti-abortion movement that they were getting a lot of criticism as being pro-fetus, you know, entirely all about the unborn child and really not thinking about the mother at all. And so back in about the 2010, 2011, they embarked on a strategy that was a big shift, although, it did have a lot of elements that were consistent with some of its other strategies, which was to try to put more focus on the mother, on protecting the health and safety of the mother. And, that happened right around the time of the Gosnell trial. There was in the trial, it was really not front page news in a lot of places, in most places, but it was obviously huge news in the pro-life anti-abortion community.
And I should add, and huge news here in Philadelphia for all the
huge,
obvious
right,
reasons.
Exactly, where it was happening. And so, the kinds of horrific things that Kermit Gosnell did, not just to the fetuses that he was delivering, but obviously to the women that he was treating and mistreating, had a major impact among anti-abortion folks, and they really saw sort of these sort of targeted laws aimed at providers as being a response. They would say it was a legitimate response that was modeled, in fact, on the grand jury report. Right. And of course, folks on the pro-choice side would say, well, it was a way of exploiting the horrific reaction, the reaction to the horrific things that Gosnell had done, and it was, TARP laws, but not just TARP laws, other kinds, TRAP laws, but not just TRAP laws, other kinds of laws as well, that were aimed at protecting women, just kind of spread like wildfire around the country, especially in the South and the Midwest.
Well, David, let me get you to weigh in on this. And as I said, this was front page news for a long time. We did several shows about this on Radio Times. I mean, and this was clearly argued or used in arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday.
Yeah, Kermit Gosnell was in the first sentence of the brief from Texas supporting their laws before the Supreme Court. He was front and center in the enactment of this law and laws all over the country following his trial. He should be vilified. He was a criminal. He did horrific things. But he's not at all representative of abortion clinics, abortion doctors. He was a criminal just like any other criminal who didn't follow the law. And the kind of nonsense that Texas is spouting is that by adding more regulations, we will stop the next Kermit Gosnell. Pennsylvania already was one of the strictest states in the country in terms of abortion regulations. He wasn't following those laws. He wasn't going to follow any new laws. If Pennsylvania could have enacted hundreds of new laws around abortion, he wasn't going to follow them because he was a criminal who was not following laws. So it doesn't make sense to think adding more laws will stop someone like Kermit Gosnell. And what's perverse about it is that it actually makes it an environment in which more Kermit Gosnells could operate.
How so?
Because and studies have shown this time and again, which is that the more you regulate abortion and restrict abortion providers, you shut down legitimate abortion providers. But what you don't do is decrease the demand for abortion. So you have fewer legitimate abortion providers, the ones who follow the law, and the demand stays the same. Women still need abortions. So it creates an environment in which a Kermit Gosnell could flourish because he operates in a legal clinic that's not following the laws. And there are women who are desperate who go to his clinic because they need services. And that's what we saw in Pennsylvania. And it would not surprise anyone if we see that in Texas if this law is fully implemented. We already know that there's an increase in the number of women who are crossing the border into Mexico to have less safe abortions or who are self-inducing in Texas. And that's the consequence of these clinic closure laws.
And part of the Gosnell case was that it had this facility, which had been described as a house of horrors, a baby charnel house. Just absolutely horrifying and obviously unsanitary conditions where illegal things were going on. But it hadn't been inspected for, what, years?
Yeah. I mean, Governor Corbett, our former governor, who was certainly a foe of abortion, he said very clearly after what happened with Gosnell, that laws were already on the books that should have prevented this situation. And then further, that this is a failure on not laws and regulations, but on people doing their jobs. He said it happened because people weren't doing their jobs, plain and simple. This was not about the failure of Pennsylvania to further regulate abortion. It was about the failure of Pennsylvania to do the job that they were supposed to do based on the books that were the laws that were already in existence.
Let me ask you another question, David. Did you want to add something to that, Nina? I heard you.
Well,
take
I just
a breath.
Want to point out that it's important to note that Texas, which has passed these incredibly restrictive laws on the pretext that they were necessary to prevent a Kermit Gosnell, was already, as you can imagine, given how conservative it is, was already regulating abortion, conducting, you know, to a degree that is really, really, really strict. They were already conducting the kinds of routine checkups on clinics and so forth. So there's really nothing like Kermit Gosnell has ever happened. Has happened in Texas in the modern era, as far as we know.
David, go ahead.
And that came up yesterday in the oral argument before the Supreme Court because Justice Breyer, in particular, and Justice Ginsburg as well, were pressing Texas to say what was happening in Texas before this law was enacted that showed a need to require doctors to have hospital admitting privileges and require clinics to be ambulatory surgical centers. Justice Breyer said, tell me one case where a woman was harmed because a doctor did not have admitting privileges. And the Texas Attorney General couldn't point to anything. All he could say was Kermit Gosnell, to which the justice said, no, tell me about Texas. Tell me something happening in Texas that indicates these laws were needed. And there was nothing.
Well, and going back to some of these requirements, and this happened, David, in Pennsylvania as well, a very specific room size, corridor widths, other very specific things that are required of abortion clinics to make them more like outpatient surgical clinics. Is there an argument to be made that an abortion is a procedure? I mean, in many cases, not a surgical procedure, but it's certainly a medical procedure.
It's certainly a medical procedure, but all over the country, doctors perform medical procedures in private offices that are not hospital operating room style offices every day, every moment of every day. And it was only abortion that was targeted this way. Most abortions, 90%+ of abortions take place in the first trimester. It's a relatively simple 5-minute procedure. It does not need a huge operating suite, the equivalent of a major hospital operating suite. They take place in warm, comfy offices that are very different than a hospital operating room, and they're very safe there. The complication rate is one of the lowest of any medical procedure, lower than, like you said, colonoscopies and liposuction. And so on the face, you know, this is one of the genius parts of laws like Texas is on the face, they sound like, yeah, that's going to increase safety. But when you look at every medical organization who has said this is completely medically unnecessary, it is not supported by medicine or facts. And in fact, it's just going to harm the care that providers give.
Let me read an email from Peter. I'll put this to you, Nina. We're almost up on our break here. Peter says, did the AMA, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, filed an amicus brief as they had in the Court of Appeal? Do you know the answer to that, Nina?
Yes, they did. And they came out very strongly against HB2 and the kinds of restrictions that it imposed in Texas and in other places for all the reasons that we've already talked about. One of the restrictions in HB2, by the way, that came up a lot in the court yesterday was the idea that medication abortion, you know, the abortion pill, that doctors need to dispense the actual pill in a clinic and in an abortion clinic, that women couldn't take the pill at home. And this left, I thought this was, although not really part of the appeal, it was something that the women justices in particular really leapt on, the idea that you had to take a pill in a surgical clinic. They just couldn't understand it. And I thought that a lot of those arguments really sort of highlighted the larger problem with the trap laws overall.
And that's Nina Martin, reporter at ProPublica, where she covers sex and gender. Also with us is David S. Cohen. He's a professor of law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law here in Philadelphia. And we're talking about yesterday's arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court, Whole Woman's Health v. Helderstedt, the first abortion-related case the court has heard in something like 9 years. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about a whole host of constitutional and legal issues with our guests David S. Cohen and Nina Martin, talking about Whole Woman's Health v. Helderstedt, and that's the case argued before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday. A challenge to a Texas law passed in 2013 that the supporters of the law said by placing restrictions on abortion clinics, it was going to protect women's health. Abortion providers arguing that the restrictions are designed to make it almost impossible for a woman to access abortion services. Also talking about a 1992 Pennsylvania case that very important, argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and the murder conviction of a Philadelphia abortion doctor, Kermit Gosnell, which has led to stricter abortion laws. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know what you think of this particular case and some of the issues at stake. David, you were telling me during the break that the AMA had an amicus brief in this particular case, and they don't always, I guess, do that.
Yeah, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has been great on these issues over the years and has been vocal before the court about it. But the American Medical Association has, as much as they've agreed usually with the ACOG position, they've been less forthcoming with their position before the court in terms of just refusing to file an amicus brief. So it was very significant that they filed an amicus brief on this issue and made it clear that these laws are medically unnecessary. And that's a very strong statement coming from them.
And even going back to Planned Parenthood v. Casey, David, it seemed as if by that decision, the court went away from the trimester view of abortion to one about fetal viability.
Yeah. A lot of people talk about Roe v. Wade being the main case around abortion, but legally, it's Planned Parenthood versus Casey because it changed a lot about Roe v. Wade. It was significant because it upheld Roe, and that was hugely important because there was a real fear in 1992 that Roe could have been overturned. So it upheld the basic idea of Roe that you can't make abortion illegal, but it changed a lot about Roe. One of the things that Roe had said was that we're going to evaluate abortion restrictions differently depending on which trimester of pregnancy we're talking about. First trimester, almost no regulation. Second trimester, some to further a woman's safety. And third trimester, states could regulate as long as the woman's life or health is an exception. Casey got rid of that and said, we just care about pre- and post-viability. And then Casey also got rid of the very strict standard from Roe, which was called strict scrutiny, and adopted this new sort of amorphous standard of undue burden. So Casey is really the most significant precedent in this area at this point.
And viability, I mean, there isn't a strict date for viability. And certainly,
right, states get to define that. And so states can leave it to the doctor's judgment, or states can have a strict line at 24 weeks, usually, like here in Pennsylvania.
And Nina, part of this law that did not really get argued before the court yesterday was that in Texas they want to, I guess, end abortions or certainly intervene in a woman's decision to have an abortion after 20 weeks. Can you address that?
Well, yes. So part of this HB2 was this requirement that abortions be banned after 20 weeks. It's part of a wave of these types of restrictions that you've seen in other states as well. There have been a lot of attempts to even go below 20 weeks. I think some states have bills, they call them fetal heartbeat bills, and they attempt to to prohibit abortion after, 6 weeks or so. The Texas restriction on abortion after 20 weeks was not, as I understand it, it was not challenged by the clinics, and it's not a part of this case. I believe it's actually gone into effect.
It has actually gone into effect. Is that true, David?
Yeah, we've seen these 20-week bans in a number of states. I think it's around a dozen now. And a lot of them, they haven't been challenged. A few have been challenged in state courts. But there was a decision not to challenge this ban at this point in time. It doesn't mean it won't be challenged later. But I think the priority was working on the parts of HB2 that shut down clinics and immediately limited access for women across the state.
I mean, I guess I don't know if this helps shed light on what we're talking about. It's when does a regulation become a ban?
Well, so we know from Casey that you can't just completely ban abortion. But the restrictions that have been put in place have been bans at certain points in time. So we've got the fetal heartbeat bans that have been enacted in states like North Dakota, and Ohio's considered it a bunch. We've got 12-week bans. Oklahoma has passed that. Those have been struck down by courts. They are clearly unconstitutional unless the Supreme Court drastically changes the way it reviews abortion laws. 20-week bans are a ban after 20 weeks, but they allow women to get abortions up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. And that is something that at this point in time, as much as I would think it's unconstitutional because the court has been clear about viability, and this is definitely pre-viability, the concern is that you would not get five justices on the Supreme Court to agree. And so the advocates' thinking is, let's not bring a case that might set a nationwide precedent with the Supreme Court adjusting abortion, the abortion standard, to be even more lax. And so maybe with a new justice appointed to the Supreme Court, if the new justice is liberal, you might see more of these 20-week bans challenged in federal court in the hopes that it would go up to the Supreme Court and they would strike it down. But up until Justice Scalia's death, the makeup of the Supreme Court was not very favorable for a 20-week ban challenge.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Joanne from Newtown to join us. Joanne, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the conversation.
Sure.
I just wanted to point out that many of the same politicians pushing these laws use the opposite argument against gun laws. So they argue that the actions of people who do things that are illegal, according to the current laws, should not drive us to be passing more gun laws restricting a person's constitutional right to bear arms. But apparently they're very comfortable with enacting unnecessary laws in the wake of someone who did something obviously illegal, restricting a woman's right to her constitutional access to abortion. It's unbelievable hypocrisy.
Well, Joanne, let me toss that first to Nina Martin. I'm sure David wants to weigh in on this as well. Nina, what do you say?
You know, I think you're right. I think that there has been an idea that's been really strongly pushed, especially on the anti-abortion side, that abortion, you know, there's an idea of abortion exceptionalism, that abortion is different, and the kinds of restrictions and the kinds of ways that abortion should be regulated and thought about and talked about by the courts and by the public is different from other kinds of rights. So you heard a little bit about, you heard some conversation about that yesterday around that issue in the oral arguments as well.
David?
And I think there's another irony is that the same politicians are very concerned about the overregulation of businesses. And what these laws do is they minutely regulate by legislators these nonprofit businesses telling them how to do their job. Amy Hagstrom Miller, who was the lead plaintiff in the case yesterday, owns several clinics that employed over 100 people in the state of Texas, and she paid her taxes and she contributed to the economy. And it's overregulation from the government that's shutting her down. These are normally arguments that would appeal to conservative legislators, but because of, as Nina said, this abortion exceptionalism, they are opposed to the overregulation of businesses in all contexts except abortion. And they're very happy for government regulation to shut down businesses, which normally conservative politicians would think is anathema.
I've always been interested in this idea of abortion as murder, and we certainly do hear it, David, from time to time. But when that argument is made, the woman who chooses to have the abortion is rarely ever cited as the criminal in the case. It's the doctor who's the criminal, not the woman choosing the abortion. It's just something that I've always found a strange argument, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, if you believe that abortion is murder, then there are two murderers. There's the woman and the doctor who does the procedure. And this gets to be a very uncomfortable question with a lot of anti-abortion people, which is very comfortable with putting the doctor in jail and less comfortable with saying that the woman should go to jail. And if it's your position that this is murder, then it seems to me that to be consistent, you should be comfortable with both of them going to jail. And you should feel there should be no exceptions, because if it's murder, it's murder. And I think that this is one of the things that sort of puts a little bit of a – shines a light on the anti-abortion position, which is that for a lot of people, they're not comfortable with putting the woman in jail. They're not comfortable with laws that have no exceptions, because they do understand, even if they can't say it, they do understand that there are reasons that should be allowed – that abortion should be allowed and that the woman shouldn't be punished. They just don't take it as far to the logical conclusion.
Right? Nina, do you want to weigh in on that? Yeah, and then we'll get some more callers
I want to point out that I think that that's generally true. I also think that what you've seen in the last couple of years are sort of little forays in different states in which women have attempted to self-induce done something that harmed their fetus and have been charged with killing their fetus or attempted murder. The most recent one happened in Tennessee. In Tennessee, actually, just a couple days ago, they decided that a woman would not be charged with, I think it was attempted murder, for self-inducing. But you're seeing that happening, attempts being made around the country. So what you're talking about is definitely part of the larger picture of of sort of the erosion of abortion rights and changes in thinking in certain parts of the country.
Let me get Jason from Graduate Hospital to join us. Hi, Jason, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I had a question from a minute ago when Professor Cohen made a comment about how the Gosnell case had a doctor who is not following existing laws to that criminal case. Where's the discussion of the existing laws providing safety? Because I find the line about new laws not preventing things, it's kind of like a gun control argument. It's very frustrating to me. So where is the discussion of the existing laws regarding safety.
Can you say that again? Both David and I have a slightly quizzical look on our face, Jason.
So the argument that if the new laws aren't being followed by criminals, passing new laws won't prevent more criminal activity. So that's kind of frustrating to me. So if the existing laws provide enough safety, mm-hmm. how are those being enforced or the regulations being observed? Where's that discussion?
Well, and I think that this was raised earlier, which is that there are laws on the book to make sure there aren't places like Kermit Gosnell's clinic. And I think what you were saying, David, is they were not being enacted or implemented.
They were being implemented in some clinics, but there was sort of this hands-off approach at Gosnell's clinic for various reasons. But Pennsylvania has plenty of laws on the books that requires all physicians and all medical facilities to comply with standard medical practices, to have basic safety and cleanliness requirements, and the list goes on. I think that what abortion rights people in clinics believe is that this is a medical procedure just like any other. And abortion clinics should be regulated the same as the dermatology office or any other private physician's office, and follow those laws and follow the medical standards of their professional organizations like the National Abortion Federation or other groups, and that the regulations on top of the standard regulations of medical procedures are really there to target abortion providers and close them down and nothing more.
Nina, a couple minutes before I have to say goodbye to both of you. So as someone who's been following cases like this and the court as well, do you have any sense of what the court might decide? And I know that there are obviously several options.
I wasn't at the oral arguments yesterday, and I think that, you know, sort of being there and really sort of seeing I read the transcripts, but hearing the tone of voice, seeing the body language, I think would have been tremendously useful. So David may have a better sense of that. You know, I think one thing to say is that there's whatever happens in this case, there's a lot of other cases out there. Some of them are trap law cases. There's one in Louisiana, and there's another in Mississippi that are both in the same circuit, appeals court circuit is Texas, that are really important. There are a lot of other there are a lot of cases pending about whether medication abortion can be regulated in some of the ways that the justices talked about yesterday. There's cases about 20-week bans and all kinds of cases out there. So abortion will still be mm-hmm. at the court. Cases will be flooding the courts and at the Supreme Court for, a long time to come, I think.
You agree with that, David?
There's no doubt that this is not the last abortion case. But I think that, what was heartening from my perspective from yesterday was that I don't see the court upholding the Texas laws with this case right now. I think there's really two options. The court may remand it to the lower courts, meaning send it back to the lower courts for further factual findings, as we talked about earlier in the hour, about the number of clinics that closed and why and what the remaining capacity is. And I think that would keep the law not in effect for now. Or they're going to strike down this law. So either way, I don't see after yesterday's oral argument the court finding that issuing a decision or an order that results in this law being upheld.
Well, on that note, we do have to end our conversation. Nina Martin, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
A reporter at ProPublica covering sex and gender, David S. Cohen, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And he's professor of law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, co-author of a book called Living in the Crosshairs. And we began with Amy Howe, editor and reporter at SCOTUS Blog. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.